static.
Welcome back to Memory Static, the podcast that digs up the movies you watched when you were little, talks about them, and throws a party to watch them. And stay tuned to the end of the episode for a new original song based on the movie we are covering. I'm your host, Bailey Moore, and I am pleased to welcome to the show Jimmy Cross. Welcome.
Hello. Yay, I'm here.
Nice to see you again.
It's good to see you again, too. For those that regularly follow the show, you'll recognize Jimmy Cross from the Witch's Night Out episode where we shared his story, and then the Gift of Winter episode where he joined an interview along with the creators of Witch's Night Out and the Gift of Winter. And I'm so glad that you're here.
Well, thank you so much. Glad to be here. Thanks again for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm in the animation industry. I'm an animation director, and I also own an animation company by the name of Uncle Porkchop Productions. Been in animation about 30 years. I'm a big Star Wars fan, big sci-fi Japanese kaiju fan, just a complete nerd. Still going strong.
I'm really looking forward to getting into this movie that we're going to be covering, because I'm sure that you know more than I do. What movie are we going to be talking about?
We are going to be talking about The War of the Gargantuas. It's a movie that I loved when I was a kid, and to this day is still a big inspiration in my life. A really great movie that I still love as an adult. I watch it at least one or two times a month sometimes. You know, it's one of those movies that just hit me as a kid.
When was the first time you ever saw it?
Oh, wow. Probably about 73, 74, I saw it. I think it was around I was 3 years old, because back in the day, in the 70s, you know, we didn't have VCRs or any of that stuff. So these things would come on like Channel 5 out here in the States. And my sister, she would watch them as a kid. She's 10 years older than I am. And so when she was watching them, I guess I watched them too. And it was just something about the Japanese monster movies that just, it grabbed me. And this movie in particular, I think I saw it the first time. It was on a smaller, like, black and white television. So Wow. It was like, wow. And I saw it, I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. And I was just remember being like, you know, should I be scared of these things, or should I, or are they cool? You know what I mean? You know, I didn't really understand what I was looking at. I saw it at my mom and dad's house. And then I saw it again, I think that week. And I said to my sister a while back, did that movie come on like every day? She said, no, it came on for a week straight. I think it was like in 74. And so I did finally saw it the last night of a Friday or something like that as color. And then I was like, oh man, this is the best movie I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I bet it really changed it seeing it in Technicolor.
Oh yeah, definitely. Because it would come on like once a year on Channel 5 out here in California. And every year it came on, I had to watch it. I had to, you know, my mom would be in the grocery store. We gotta get home. It's gonna be 5 o'clock. I gotta see Gargantuas. You know, so, you know, I loved it. It was just one of my favorite movies. And it's so funny because back then, like, you know, shows would come on like The Wizard of Oz every year and completely forget the whole plot and the story because you're just a kid and there's other things in your life. You're playing and sports and stuff. And every year it was brand new to me. It was brand new. I never knew when the Green Gargantua was going to pop up and grab the girls singing. And it was just a movie that just stuck with me, you know?
When you were a kid watching this, did you understand that one of the Gargantuas was good and the other one was, I mean, not that it's bad, but wasn't used to people?
Oh, yeah, I totally got it. I think later on when I got a little older, like 5 or 6, I finally sat down and watched the movie as a whole. You know, you start comprehending things a little better. Because before, when I was way younger, it's like, I just want to see the monsters. These people are talking too much. You know? You know, then finally I got it. And there were some scenes that I guess I wasn't paying attention to. And I finally got to see him eat the lady in the airport. And I was like, whoa, this is okay. He's not good. He's something wrong with this one. You know, and I remember like rooting for the brown one because he was so good and he was trying to stop his brother from eating people. And I just remember him shaking his head, and I didn't like that green one. You know, it wasn't until I got older that I appreciated him.
Eats a lady and spits out her clothes on the ground.
Yeah, spits the clothes out. Very cartoony.
For listeners that haven't seen this movie yet, can you give a brief summary of what this movie is about?
So this was supposed to be a sequel to a movie that I saw later on in life, Frankenstein Conquers the World. And it took place in Japan. And it was a kid. He had Frankenstein's heart. And he grew tremendously. And he fought another monster by the name of Baragon, which is one of the Godzilla monsters. There's two versions of this. One, he sunk into the ground. And the other version, an octopus came out of nowhere and dragged him into the sea. And the flesh of the Frankenstein basically made the brown gargantua. So he's the cells of the Frankenstein, from what I understand. And so the brown gargantua grew up and got captured by the scientists and escaped, I guess, the following year and lived in the wild. So he was used to humans. But I guess somewhere along the ocean, he scraped himself on a rock or something, and the flesh went into the ocean and grew on protein-rich plankton and turned into the green gargantua. So these are humanoid cells from this original Frankenstein. This is supposed to be a sequel, but the characters that were in the first one aren't the same characters in the second one. And Nick Adams was in the Frankenstein Conquers the World and Rebel Without a Cause and a couple other Japanese movies. And in this one, Russ Tamlin from West Side Story was in War of the Gargantuas. Mm-hmm. So the story, I guess it takes place a little bit after that. And this green gargantua comes up from the sea and fishermen are seeing him. There's all these sightings, like Bigfoot sightings and stuff like that. And then finally, I guess he got really hungry and came ashore and attacked Tokyo Airport, where he ate the lady and then escaped back into the sea. The scientists were seeing all these footprints and mountains, and they were like, you know, how is this monster moving so fast? Maybe there's two of them. They didn't have any evidence of that yet until later on when the gargantua came to sea again. I guess he got hungry again, and the army was waiting for him. This is the first time ever that a Japanese monster was completely injured. The army destroyed this guy. I mean, knocking the flesh off of him and basically injured, almost killed him, you know, in the forest. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the brown gargantua comes and saves him. Doesn't know his brother is savagely eating people and stuff like that. So he tries to take care of him. So they're out on the lookout for these two. And the one scientist says, oh, this is our baby that escaped. And now he's big now. So the brown gargantua finds out that his brother is eating people. I guess he sees clothes all over the place. And then an all-out battle happens in the forest. And they go on this chase and they fight in Tokyo Bay and go into the ocean. And then out of nowhere, underground volcano swallows them both up. And that's the end.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's just your knockout, wrestling, flipping, you know, crashing into buildings, entertainment.
I am really glad that you gave us the background of the first movie, because I did learn that this movie was a sequel, but I haven't seen the first one. And I feel like it must be clearer about the scraping of the flesh and how a gargantua can grow out of that, because I was a little confused watching this movie. I was like, so they're brothers and they have the same DNA? I was a little confused, but it seems that watching the first one probably makes it a little bit clearer.
Like I said, there's no connection to the two films. There's only one connection when Paul Stewart, the doctor in the War of the Gargantua, says, he's talked about another scientist finding a hand in some area. And in the Frankenstein Conquers the World, they cut his hand off to see if it would grow back. And it
did.
That's the only connection. And the fact that they're humanoid, the gargantuas, if flesh comes off of them, it'll grow into another gargantua. That's why they were always debating in the film, if we start using these rays on these guys, you're going to blow these bits all over the place. We're going to have 1,000 of these things all over the place.
Right.
So they, I guess that got ignored, because at the end they were blasting.
They're going to have a lot more gargantuas.
And I guess there was going to be another sequel to this. They were going to fight Godzilla, from what I understand. And they did fight Godzilla in a comic book.
Oh.
They're much smaller than Godzilla. They're more on the scale of the original King Kong. I think they're only 50-foot tall guys. Another thing I love about the Gargantua's movie, the miniatures, even though they're miniatures, they were so detailed because they were scaled down. They weren't as big as Godzilla was. So they were scaled down, so you get to see little trees and little places where people were eating. And it was just genius the way they handled these miniatures and just the detail they put into having stuff in the foreground and stuff in the background, and the stuff in the foreground was huge and the stuff in the background had less detail. That is another thing that I enjoyed as I got older. Of course, you know, we know they're two men in a suit, but just the fact that you could see their eyes in the suit, it made them a little bit scarier and a little bit real, a little bit more alive, even though the face is the same exact face, but you're looking at the eyes, you can see a lot of the emotion in the characters. Haru Nakajima played the Green Gargantua, who also played Godzilla in almost like 18 films.
Oh, wow.
And he said that this was his favorite role to play because he was able to not be so confined in the Godzilla neck and almost feel like he was in a coffin. But this time he was able to be agile and use his eyes and use his head and look around and things like that. And
oh, it was a really... Oh, the miniatures. I wanted to say, like, the miniatures are so incredible. Watching them fall apart and realizing that there's detail on the inside, too.
Exactly.
It's really, really amazing. What was your favorite part when you were little, and is it still your favorite part?
Basically, now it's pretty much the whole film. I can sit and watch it while I'm drawing or whatever. I can just have it on. And my daughter, she's a big fan of it now. So we'll sit down and watch it together. And there's pictures of her pointing at the Green Gargantua. You know, so my favorite part is probably is two different scenes. It's the one scene where he just rescues the Green Gargantua. His name is in Japan is Gaira. And the brown one is Sanda, you know, from the earth, you know. So I think when he's splashing water on him to keep him alive and he's comforting him, and then the helicopter comes by and the two look around and literally they don't trust anybody anymore, humans. And so one of them hides in the sea and one hides behind a tree. Those kind of things, it brought a lot of personality to them, a lot of human qualities that, you know, you can understand, you know, they're trying to hide from the pain and the hurt, but you could still see in the Green Gargantua's eyes, he's still just very evil, even in that scene. It felt like to me as a kid, like all he's doing, he's just getting patched up, but he's not changing. He's not going to change if his brother cares about him. I think that scene and the scene where the brown gargantua discovers his brother is still eating people, and just that look that the Green Gargantua gives him, like, yeah, what are you going to do about it? He just boldly went right back to sleep, like, bring it.
That's so good.
He brought it. Tried to hit him with a tree, and that guy was just ready to go. He never changed in that whole movie. There was no arc in the Green Gargantua at all. vicious to the end.
So you mentioned that you had a sister that's older.
Yeah.
Did you always get along with your sister when you were younger?
Yeah, I did. I was a pain in the butt. I was that little brother. It was like, give me a quarter, I'm telling mom. You know, and then you give me a quarter anyway, and I still tell, you know, and then later on, I totally forget that I told on her, and then I just get a beating. Like, why are you hitting me? What did I do? You know, 10 years is a long time. And, you know, you got to remember, like, I'm 10 and she's 20, you know, heading into college and stuff like that. So, yeah, I was the tag along. I went on the dates and wore a Darth Vader mask on her date on purpose. You know, they're in the movie theater and I got this mask on my head, and the lady sitting next to me is like, I think you're in the wrong theater, son. And my sister's all, I'm going to kill him. I did it on purpose. That's what little brothers do, I guess. But it was fun. It's all great memories. Right. I love my sister.
I'm 10 years older than my brother. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
So I need to talk to him, not you. I need to talk to him because he and I can have war stories, not you, because you'll say, oh, everything was great. It was fun. And he was such a great brother and this and that. No, I need to talk to your brother.
Yeah, pretty much. That's kind of how it goes. Yeah. So like the gargantuas, did you invent monsters when you were a kid? Like a monster in the closet or anything like that? Oh,
yeah. According to my dad, he would come to see us and they would go, where's Jimmy? And then they would see a bunch of kids running down the street. And then he goes, there is Jimmy. And Jimmy's acting like Godzilla, running down and chasing after kids. And, you know, and stuff. I had a little comic strip when I was like 7. And it was almost like the War of the Gargantua. It was these killer octopus characters that were fighting. And the one octopus was a mutant octopus that had machine guns on his forehead. I made the whole thing out of Crayola markers. No words to it. It's just a notebook with all these different things and the octopus ripping apart sharks and grabbing the girl and took the girl underneath the water with them. But the girl never came up for air for some odd reason. It was like 6 or 7 panels. She's still under the water, you know, and just... then he fights a purple octopus. I think I still have that book somewhere, but yeah, they end up killing both of them. And then I just wrote in big letters, the end.
I've always liked the idea that a giant octopus could be somewhere in the ocean because they're so smart. Oh, and they're such cool animals.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So the version of War of the Gargantuas that we're going to be talking about, as far as I know, the one that you sent me is only available on a kaiju fan page on Facebook called the Kaiju Fan Club Buenos Aires.
To tell you the truth, there's three different versions. There's the Japanese version, which basically had totally different music in it. And then there's this international version that's on HBO Max. The dubbing is not good at all. And it's not even Russ Tamlin's voice. But the one I send you is the one I grew up with. And that's the one that the only one they put on DVD of that is literally the last of that cut. And that's the cut that everybody in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s grew up with.
Yeah. I wonder why it's so hard to find other than the link that you sent me.
Well, it was on Netflix for a while, and then that one went off. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I think the Criterion Collection released the international version, the dub one that's on HBO Max. And the film quality is really dark. And the Japanese version one, the film quality is really dark. But the one version that Henry Saperstein, the one I gave you, is really bright. And the dubbing is really good on that one. And Russ Tamlin did go in and dub on top of his voice on that one. He wasn't speaking Japanese at all on that. Yeah, that's the best one. And the only version you can find on that one is probably DVD and the Facebook thing I found for you, which was like, thank God I found this one. So I didn't want her to look at the other one.
Thank goodness. And because this movie is only available on Facebook, I've had all of the party guests watch the movie on their own. What we normally do is we try to watch it together, but I couldn't figure out how to do it with Facebook. So there is really no need for the time machine, really, except for its cool factor. That, and I've got to keep it running regularly or things might break down. And that's really not great when messing with the speed of time. So, Jimmy, I have sent your door to the time machine to your coordinates, and it should be appearing any time now. Let me know when you see it.
It's a really big door. Wow. Okay, I see it.
So you go through your door, and I'll go through my door, and I'll see you inside the time machine. So this is the slow-moving time machine. We could have continued the conversation over Zoom, but this is better, right?
Yeah.
Do you understand where we are right now and what it does?
You're going to have to tell me.
Okay. I should really get better about like letting people know before we step into the time machine, but I keep forgetting. So what has happened is we have walked into the slow-moving time machine, which moves slightly faster than real time. So usually when we use it, it's so that the party can watch the movie and we can talk about the movie and be done around the same time. And what it also does is it splits our existences into two. So you are actually outside the time machine at the same time that you're in the time machine. So when you get off the time machine, you have two timelines that create memories that overlap a little bit.
Okay.
So I am really excited to talk to you about War of the Gargantuas. And you probably know all of this information already, and some of it you've already touched on. So if there's anything that I say incorrectly, just let me know. So this was released in Japan in 1966 and subsequently the United States in 1970. And since this is the first kaiju movie we've covered on this podcast, I'd like to give a little general background on the genre. Jimmy, what does kaiju mean?
It means monsters.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the films always feature giant city-destroying monsters. So we know that the monsters in War of the Gargantuas are kaiju monsters. Can you name some of the other really popular ones?
Yeah. Well, of course, you have Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And you have Rodan. You have Mothra. You have Ghidorah. Anguirus. Destroya. Space Godzilla. Manda. Little Manila, Minya, Higa, Gorosaurus, Gigan, Megalon. there's a lot of them.
Which would you say is the most famous?
Of course, Godzilla.
Godzilla. And,
Godzilla and Mothra are pretty much really famous. And King Ghidorah is starting to get famous now because of the American movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will say that the movie that I grew up watching was Mothra. I loved that movie.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Godzilla came out in 1954 and is regarded by some as the first kaiju movie. What do you know about the origins of kaiju movies?
Just that there was one before that. I think it got lost in a fire. There was a kaiju movie. I think it had to do with like a Buddha or a monk or something. There's like pictures of it somewhere, but that's lost forever. But then the producer of Toho was really, really a big fan of King Kong when it came out in the States. And he wanted to adapt some kind of movie of that. They didn't know what Godzilla was going to be. They didn't know in the beginning that it was going to have such an impact because of the war and stuff like that. But the story was that it was because of what happened and the bombing of Hiroshima and stuff like that. It turned into this dinosaur, this monster, this mass destruction. And the first film was so, so heartbreaking and so heavy, you know, that it just became a smash. To me, honestly, to tell you the truth, out of all the kaiju films, that film has the most emotion in it, and the human characters and the monster characters, it blends so well, where you do have this love triangle between the scientists and the soldier and the other character, how the scientist, he won't have the love of the girl and ends up sacrificing himself for the world and destroying Godzilla, and just the whole weight of it on people seeing like what the devastation of that bomb, what it did. Seeing it through this film and seeing it through this mass destruction. I love that Godzilla was a force of nature in that one. Don't get me wrong, I love my 60s and 70s campy Godzilla, but that one was, I didn't really understand the first Godzilla until I got older. It was probably about when I was like a teenager when I kind of saw that film. That's when it gripped me as like, okay, this is a really, really strong human emotions going on in this film. Godzilla, by far, the first Gojira movie was the best. Totally forgot that it was a guy in a suit because right. of the story.
Yeah, Tomoyuki Tanaka really hit on something very poignant in yes. taking how much he liked the monster movies from Hollywood and mashing it together with what was going on in Japan and like the very real fears there. And it made an incredible movie that was hugely successful and created this whole new genre of film, which I think is really amazing.
Exactly. I was going to say, what a great turn of events to where they couldn't afford to do stop motion in Japan. And they said, well, let's just put a guy in a suit. And that in itself brought it even more into a...
Uh-oh. Hold on 1 second.
I love stop. It's so organic. You can touch those things. You know, and but it's just even more with
this suit. It just feels like a...
Oh, no.
You there, baby?
Really? I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I've moved a little bit.
Okay.
I'm not going anywhere.
So I didn't get to hear all that you were saying about the people in the suits, but it's funny because that's exactly where I wanted to go next, was to talk right. about what the special effects that really set this apart as a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, would you mind saying what you were saying before?
To their loss of not being able to have the budget to do stop motion animation was our gain to have them be able to do these guys in suits, because it just, to me, I couldn't imagine any other way doing the genre than having the men in suits. You know, I love stop motion, like I was saying before, because of the organic, you know, you can actually touch those things and they feel real. But then also I feel the same way about a man in a suit, you know, especially if you're able to do it correctly to where the monster looks real and the sets look real and the miniatures look real. And just the time and effort it takes to do that, and just the ingenious of just having little rockets shooting these guys and little lights and trains moving and cars moving. It's just, you know, being an artist, I look at the craftsmanship and I respect that.
You mentioned the special effects artist before.
Yeah, Eiji Tsuburaya. You know, he was a Toho effects director. I think he started off doing like World War II or propaganda films, and they were so real that people over here in the States are like, you know, is this real footage or is this not? So sophisticated for the time, you know. And he had a crew of people, of course. There were two actors that played Godzilla in the original one, but Hiro Nakajima was the one that was the most in the Godzilla suit, and he would go on to play Godzilla in multiple films. And not only that, he would go off and do all the, you know, the fight scenes and choreograph the other actors. And as a matter of fact, War of the Gargantua was choreographed by him.
One of the things that I thought was really cool to learn was that along with the actor in the monster costume, or the suit, against the miniatures to make him appear gigantic, they're also filmed at double speed so that when it's slowed down, the movements appear slower in relation to the smaller human characters, which exactly. I think is so cool. And you can see this effect mimicked in a lot of things, like in cartoons. And the one that immediately came to mind is in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. The adults and the dog that are huge in relation to the shrunken down kids are moving much slower.
Yeah. And here's another funny story about that. Immediately after the first 1955 Godzilla came out, they were already making a sequel. And in the sequel is when they wanted to have him fight another monster, and the monster was Anguirus. In that film, they did the same exact thing with the speeding up the camera. But I guess in somewhere in the editing process or some film process, that got swapped. So the camera stayed on high speed. So in that film, the monsters are going 50 miles an hour and they're just breaking buildings and it's going really fast. Oh, wow. Stuff like that. So, and they never changed it. And I was like, okay, this is kind of weird. Some scenes is really, they're going real slow, but there's other scenes there. It literally looks like a Charlie Chaplin film. There's just crashing and falling and stuff like that. So they never changed it. So
yeah.
Only in that film.
So this particular movie, as well as a lot of other kaiju movies, was directed by Ishiro Honda. And one thing that I found particularly surprising was learning of UPA's involvement in the film.
Yeah.
I am more familiar with knowing UPA as a pioneer of American animation. Which we talk about a little bit in an earlier episode of Memory Static when we talked about Gay Peri.
Oh my God, I love that movie.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. But apparently in 1970, UPA closed its animation studio permanently and sold its library of cartoons and gained a contract with Japan's Toho Studios to distribute its kaiju films to young American audiences who loved them and had quickly developed a strong cult following for these movies. This was actually the last movie that was an effort to co-produce one of these films with Toho Studios. Yes. So when you brought this movie to me, you were adamant that it be the version with Russ Tamblyn's voice, because that's the one you grew up with.
Yeah, that he didn't really see the film until later on in life and then kind of appreciated it, you know, what everybody was talking about.
What I had learned, this is what I wanted to talk about, was that it's interesting because there are, like you said, three different versions of this movie. You have the Japanese version, the international version that you mentioned, where someone else is dubbing Russ Tamblyn rather than him delivering his own lines. And then you have him delivering his lines in English and everybody else is dubbed in English. Yeah. And if you're looking really closely, it looks as though Russ Tamblyn is dubbed as well, but it is his voice. And what I thought was interesting was that he had improvised all of his lines and that the original soundtrack was lost and he had to come back in to re-record his lines and he didn't have a script to work with. So he had to lip read himself and try to come up with what he was that he was saying.
Oh man. Okay. Yeah. It makes total sense because some of the words are not hooking up right. You can see on the, but then if he made some of that stuff up, he said some really cool stuff that like, stuck with me as a kid. Like, just letting you know, we're not looking for a toy poodle or, you know, that big brown teddy bear has a crush on you. You know, if he made that stuff up, then that made the film classic. So
Right. Yeah, no, there was definitely some really clever lines there. But I just thought that was really interesting because I was texting my sister last night while she was watching it. And she does voice acting for anime. And so she noticed it. Like, I hadn't really picked up on it. I just read about it. But she was like, is Russ Tamblyn, did he dub himself?
Yeah.
So I thought that's really amazing that she figured that out.
There's a trailer for War of the Gargantuas. It's called something different, Frankenstein Monsters. But you can hear Russ Tamblyn's actual voice, and it sounds like he's in the room. So yeah, you're correct that there are two different versions.
So there's a few more things about the film's impact and its music that I wanted to talk about before we get out of the time machine and talk to everybody else. So I learned that you are not alone in your appreciation of this film, that it's a favorite of several big directors, including Guillermo del Toro and Tim Burton. As a cult classic, it is pretty influential. I told you about my experience when I was watching the movie for the first time, and it got to the part where it has that song where the woman's singing at the club, and it's the words get stuck in my throat. And I thought I was losing my mind because I recognized the song, even though I'd never seen the movie before. And I realized I had seen it in a Scooby-Doo cartoon, Mystery Incorporated. And I didn't know the time, but the episode turns out to be a straight parody of War of the Gargantuas and is called Battle of the Humongonauts.
Yeah.
So it's pretty obvious when you know, but I didn't know.
Right. I love that song.
But I love that song. I was telling my sister that I wanted to learn how to play it on the ukulele. She actually also wants to learn how to play it.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, it was written for this movie.
Yeah, I think it was I think she was an American actress. I think her name is Kip Hamilton or something like that. The only thing I would know it from is War of the Gargantuas. And it's just one of those things that's just buried in my head forever. You know, it'll be there for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I've been humming it to myself for a couple days. Talking about the music, I just wanted to mention that I love all of the music in this, all the horns that play. It's just really great. The composer is Akira Ifukube, who classical and film composer. And this was really interesting, and I'm sure that you know this already, but he invented the Godzilla roar.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know how that was done?
I think it was a bass, and he took the strings and he rubbed it with a metal glove and slid it down, and it made the noise.
So,
and over time, they sped up. And there's a lot of other sounds in there, like elephants and things like that. But that noise is from the bass, him taking the glove and pulling it, from what I heard. But then over time in the 60s, they sped it up to make it sound like the Godzilla we knew in the 60s and the 70s.
I love learning stuff like that because I think that coming up with sounds to represent other things that they aren't at all takes such tremendous imagination that it's so neat to me.
And speaking of the composer, which is one of my favorites, his music for the Godzilla films and just War of the Gargantuas is the most beautiful sounding stuff. His military marches are great. It's so uplifting and so let's get ready for battle and just the monster clashing stuff, all that stuff. It's iconic. You put that in a melting pot with all the other directing stuff that goes on and you have a great Toho kaiju film. When you hear dun, 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 that's Godzilla coming from the ground. It's like, oh, here he comes.
Yeah, yeah. It's like musical cues for things, which the music becomes a character on its own.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, it's just the Gargantua sounds. I mean, I love the way the green Gargantua screams and hollers everywhere. It's just so great.
Do you know anything about how that sound was made?
I heard a rumor, but just by listening, it sounds like a higher pitched version of the King Kong sound effect from King Kong versus Godzilla. It goes from high to low and it's the same cadence, but it's just sped up. I don't know. But I'm just assuming in my head that, oh, this is just a speed up version of King Kong. That's just my intuition thinking. Even just the sound that he makes and then the secondary sounds, like he's grunting and things like that, it just turns him into a living animal. You know, I love it.
It's awesome. Is there anything else that you would like to cover with this movie before we step out of the time machine and join everybody else?
It's just a movie that it's just a part of me. It's something that everybody knows I love it. It's something I grew up with, something that I always cherish. There's a lot of memories. People in general, when they identify with something that they watched as a kid, you always remember the smells, the sounds, the things that were around you, you know, when you watched it and how you thought about it and how it kind of like left your life for a while, because it did leave my life for many, many years. And then it just finally came back when I was in my 20s. And then when it finally comes back, okay, you get that feeling again. I feel like I'm six again. It's just a really big part of my life. And yeah, it's just one of those movies I can just carve out the sand, you know, one of my favorites.
It's really cool how movies kind of function as a time capsule, not just for the time that the movie was made in, but also the experience that you had watching it. And you can take it and have that experience. Like you were saying, you have that experience again, and it's like you feel all the things that you felt before. It's really fascinating.
Exactly. Yeah, it's wonderful how film works and how things that you watch, how it's part of your creative DNA. It's really, honestly, to tell you the truth, there's really nothing really original out there. It's always a building block of somebody else's creativity, and you just build on top of that. And, you know, there's many films in my bag that does that to me. And this is just happens to be one of them. And I just really gravitate towards those monsters.
With that, let's step out of the time machine and join everybody else.
Oh, reality.
Hi.
How's it going?
Pretty well. I finished the interview with Jimmy a few moments ago, and this is a really, really special movie to him. So I'm very excited to get everybody else's takes.
So we have exited the slow-moving time machine, and we have the Zoom party here that's been waiting for us. So I hope that you're feeling okay, Jimmy, after stepping off of the time machine.
I want to go back.
Do you like having two separate, timelines of memories? Because I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's really cool. But I love those memories as a kid.
Absolutely. So I just want to say hello to everybody that has come, and thank you so much for watching the movie that Jimmy picked. And I'm really excited to hear your thoughts. What was your favorite part of War of the Gargantuas and why?
Do you want us to introduce ourselves first?
Oh, yeah, you could do that. Here?
Okay. Hi, Chaney here.
I am Kate.
Hi, Cullen here.
And hello, I'm Bailey.
I'm Jimmy.
So Bailey and I watched this movie together. Well, I started it by myself last night, and then I messaged her and I was like, this movie is wild. It's fun. It's just fun. I really enjoyed it. I think my favorite part though was, what is his name? Russ?
Russ Tamblyn.
Yeah. I think it was his reactions when his partner, the woman, kept finding herself in a bind. His reactions, I think, were my favorite part.
What we were texting back and forth last night, I could not stop laughing when the partner falls off the cliff and she needs help. And Russ Tamblyn's reaction is just slightly puffing his cheeks. It's so good.
Do you need help?
Yeah. So nonchalant. Just stay there. Don't panic. I'll be down in a minute.
As she's dangling from a branch off of a 50-foot cliff.
Yeah.
I will say that Russ Tamblyn's character, what is his character's name, Jimmy?
Dr. Paul Stewart.
Dr. Paul Stewart. So I will say, in a disaster situation, Dr. Paul Stewart keeps a very level head.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. He was kind of too chill the entire time. he seemed really uninvested in what was going on, even though this is supposedly his science baby.
At the during the climax of the movie, when his assistant gets injured, he's just like, "Oh, you're not dead? That's cool. I thought you were."
The part which is actually like directly before when she falls off the cliff, when they're just in this like resort forest, there's a group of tourists singing. Everybody in the park is singing the same song at the same time. And no one's told them that they might die.
I told Bailey that was me and my friends. We just go singing everywhere and are oblivious to our surroundings.
Right.
My favorite part was probably the Kraken at the beginning and the fight between the big ape and the Kraken.
Right.
And at the end of the movie, when the military, I guess, bombed some volcanoes into activity, I thought that they had awakened like a larger Kraken.
Yeah.
And I was like so excited for like this uber kaiju battle. And then they were just like, yeah, they died.
I like your idea about the big octopus. That would have been awesome. Just a huger one to swallow them both up.
I thought those were going to be the clashing gargantuans. But then that fight was over and we didn't see another gargantuan for like another third of the movie.
Yeah, I totally the same thought, Kate. I was like, oh, like cool, like a giant squid and a monster. This is like already starting action packed. And I like how
we're on the right page.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, we're just gonna not talk about this giant squid, like a creature that really exists in real life. Right.
Yeah. Nobody mentioned the Kraken the entire movie.
Well, speaking of that octopus, the reason why he did exist is because this movie actually is a sequel to another kaiju film called Frankenstein Conquers the World. The story is that this Frankenstein monster was formed and it was a boy that turned into a giant monster and fought another monster in that movie. But at the end of that movie, there's a cut that didn't make it into the theater where a giant octopus drags Frankenstein into the water and drowns him. And the remains of Frankenstein turns into the brown gargantua. And then the brown gargantua gets captured, as you saw in the movie. But as he gets older, he cuts himself on a mountain or a rock or something. And that flesh went into the ocean and turned into the green gargantua. So these things, their flesh, if it gets cut off, they spawn into another gargantua. There's a lot of people are trying to connect this with Attack on Titan, that these basically this is the future of gargantuas.
I just want to know what the minimum mass you need to spawn a gargantuan is, because like they are mammals, which means they're shedding cells all the time.
Right.
So they were concerned about like bombing them and spawning like thousands of gargantuans.
And they're blowing them up.
If you bomb them good enough, like if you evaporate them, then that shouldn't be a problem.
Right.
I do have to say that the brown gargantuan was much cuter.
Yeah, when we only saw the green gargantuan, every time his face came on the screen, I had to like take a minute and be like, wow, that is an ugly guy. They did a good job on that.
There was also basically this was inspired off of a book called The Sea Boy and the Mountain Boy. It was like a Japanese book, and that kind of inspired this whole brothers and, you know, one from the land, one from the sea, you know, and everything has
I would have loved it if they had used those titles in the dub.
Yeah.
Like, the new designations for the two monsters are Land Boy and Sea Boy.
Yeah, well, actually, the original name, because they weren't gargantuas in Japan, as you know, they were Frankenstein monsters. So one was called Gaira and the other one was Sanda. Sanda was the brown one. So it was the Frankenstein brother, Sanda versus Gaira. I think that was the Japanese title, I think. You know, and when it came here in the States, a producer here turned them into gargantuas for some reason and called it War of the Gargantuas and added new music and everything to it.
Bailey, did you have a favorite part?
Oh, my favorite part was the lounge singer part, hands down. I loved that entire scene. And to me, it was very much like, speaking of things it reminded me of, because I know that I think Tarantino really likes this movie a lot. And it reminds me of in Kill Bill Volume 1, the whole club scene, like where just everything, like all hell breaks loose. And so like, that's what it very much made me think of, down to I think the 5, 6, 7, 8s are what the name of the band is, like even down to almost their dress. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like screaming Kill Bill Volume 1. But that was my favorite part, hands down, because she was not doing anything. She was not bothering anybody. She was just singing her heart out, and then she gets got. And I was like, I'm so sorry, my friend. You're just trying to do your thing and live your life.
Can I change my favorite part, Bailey?
Yes.
When other Bailey was talking, it reminded me of what my actual favorite part was, which was the airport scene when he swipes away half the building. And then that poor woman is there and he grabs that girl. And I was like, oh, it's going to be like a King Kong moment. And, you know, fall in love with the girl. Next thing I know, she is eaten whole. And then her clothes are spit out.
Put her clothes on her hair.
It made me so happy.
I think it's
happy.
Her clothes.
Oh.
I love it if it was her wig, though. That makes it even better.
You got this savage monster, and he has so sophistication to take the bones out or keep the bones out.
It was unexpected to me. And so that made me really happy that it was just so gruesome instead.
I really like the sound effects they used with the monsters, especially with the spitting the clothes out. It sounded kind of like a vacuum tube, like at the bank.
Pukasu, did you have a favorite part?
Yeah, well, okay. I don't know if I had a favorite part. I'm really bad at favorites. I don't even have like a favorite color, but something that I did notice was like, if I could be any inanimate object in this whole film, it would be Akimi's hats. And I was just like, every time, like every new scene, new hat, new style. Also, the one thing that I thought was absolutely just not believable was their hiking outfits. I think it's like the first 15 minutes. I couldn't let it go. I was like, this guy looks like he's going to go ride a horse. Like, I was just like outraged. I think I Googled, because I watched this late at night while my baby was sleeping. I like Googled this guy's outfit. I was like, what is he wearing? So
I had the same moment when they were climbing up the mountain, and like most of the guys, at least the Japanese guys, are dressed in like heavy coats. And then the American scientist has like a jacket, and then Akemi is just wearing a t-shirt.
You know, it's funny that Pukasu, you were talking about if you would be anything in the movie, you would be Akimi's hats. So I actually wanted to ask, like, if you were anything in this movie, what do you think you'd be?
What do we think we'd be, or what do we want?
What do you want to be?
That woman getting eaten, for sure.
Wow. Who said that?
I would want to be all of the torn off skin cells that reproduce and make more monsters.
That's true. All of them?
Every single one of them, yes.
I choose to be the person who's in charge of pointing all of the little laser turrets, because that's a lot of electrical power right there.
They had like three different
guys.
There's
one laser turret it's in the final fight when Brown Gargantua is on the ground and Green One is over him. And the first laser that shoots is right in the tuchus. Oh. And
You really watched this movie.
I did.
I remember I was like, oh, I saw that too. I was like, oh. I would love to be the Brown Gargantua.
Even though he dies?
Yeah, even though he goes. He goes out good. He's a good guy. I like the Brown Gargantua.
Don't worry, Jimmy. When I grow back from your multiple cells, I will reincarnate myself as you, as Brown Gargantua.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think if I were to be anything in the movie, I'd want to be the octopus at the beginning, even though it gets eaten. I think being a giant octopus, I think like the only thing that you'd really have to fear other than the Gargantua are whales. And, you know, for the most part, there's going to be quite a battle there before anything happens with a whale.
Just real quick, for those who have not yet been on this podcast, second time Bailey has mentioned a cephalopod.
Is it?
Yeah. It was our last video.
Dot and the Whale?
Yeah. I just love how your cephalopod love comes out in every podcast. All right, that should be like a new theme.
Well,
I
mean, they're incredibly smart, and that fits. So,
oh,
see, I'm a kind, loving sister.
Yeah,
or at least as smart as a cephalopod, Bailey.
Ah, thank you. So if you were a giant monster, what would be the first thing that you'd do?
I think I would do all the things that I'm physically incapable of doing in this human body. Like, I doubt I will ever go to the top of Everest. So I would do that as a monster, or go to the depths of the ocean. Yeah, just one step, you know. Got it. Just see things that I am not going to have the privilege of seeing as a human.
You can cut this out if it's too deep of a cut, but if Chaney's going to do all the things that she can't do as a human, I think the first thing she would do is eat bread.
I would eat all of the bread. I would eat all of the bread in the world. No one would have bread left.
And that's how she would end the world. Shortage.
One baguette at a time.
I'd probably slightly let my presence known. Hopefully I can have a voice to say, hi, I'm not here to hurt you guys. I'm just swimming. Just, you know.
It'd be fun to do it like Charlotte's Web style. I would just stay as hidden as possible. And when no one's around, emerge and make like really artistic large things and then disappear again.
Based on like Jimmy just said, I feel like I'd be a really big, like gargantuan size duck for these reasons. Ducks are like half professionals at all that they do. Like, they can walk, but they're not very good at it. They can fly, they're not very good at it. And they can swim, but they're like so buoyant that like they're not going very far, you know.
So, what would your monster cry be? F-whack!
Yes, and then I would get sued. I'd be like that monster in like litigation, and like litigation happened forever. It'd be awful.
Like, are you the duck monster? You've been served.
I don't think anybody's gonna sue a 50-foot duck, okay? I think he can do whatever he wants.
But then also, like, so right now in Seattle, all the geese and goslings are hanging out together, and all the ducks and ducklings are hanging out together. And like, if I was a big duck and I had little baby ducks, oh my God, they're so cute. I would just have a whole gang of little ducklings and just terrorize the town in cuteness. It'd be so cute. We'd like hold up traffic. They'd all follow me.
Yeah. You guys wouldn't destroy buildings because you guys would all walk in a straight line down the street, you know?
So the only bad thing though is that like we definitely have to hire a few people in the city to like collect all the down that would just shed off. Like I'd be creating jobs, you know.
I would share my bread with you and your ducklings.
This is perfect. That's the perfect team.
Your duck hypothetical implies the presence of a second giant duck. Where is that duck in this situation?
What's it called? It's reptiles do it. Humans can't do it.
Lay eggs?
No.
Have cold blood?
It's called something genesis, like apothemogenesis, where you can reproduce based on your own cells. You don't need another.
Oh.
It's like the gargantuas. Yeah.
Parthenogenesis. Google it. That's how I would do it.
Yeah. Okay.
Big ducks around. Parthenogenesis.
Like fungus.
Let me tell you, fungus is a great name for a duck. I'm Fungus, the duck.
That's pretty good.
Bailey. Enoia would just be like a giant baby. Like, that's all Enoia would be.
That'd be cool.
That'd be actually a terrible monster. Like, that monster would wreak some havoc.
His weapon is spit up.
Like, the only thing that'll soothe
it's like, like acid.
And it like only gets worse. You're like, how do we calm the baby? And you're like, giant breasts. It's like, no. There's no easy solution to killing off a giant baby.
I wasn't gonna go there.
Bailey, did you have one?
I mean, so I watched this movie casually at 4 a.m. And so I was like, what if I made a music video? And I don't really have anything to back up. I have no ideas out of that. But I was like, I just want to be a giant creature who makes a really cool music video. And that's all that I have. And I was like, going to change my answer. And then I was like, no, I stand by that.
Yeah, I love that you don't want to just make a music video. You want to be a giant monster who makes a music video.
Exactly. I was like, I don't know where that context came from. I don't know where that idea came from at 4 a.m., but I was like, I'm sticking with it.
Monsters have creative dreams too.
Exactly. That's all I'm saying. I'm trying to bring attention to the arts for giant monsters, and that's all I'm saying.
Well, does anyone have any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
I don't think that the gargantuas are actually dead. I don't think the volcano killed them. I was fully expecting a hand to come out at the end. It didn't, but I still think that if the camera had stayed on that spot for another 3-5 seconds, we would have seen some fingers and hands coming up.
That'd have been cool. I would have loved that. I always wondered too, because of the cells multiplying, did the volcano burn up all the cells or did it split even more? So is there a whole world of gargantuas now?
I just want to give a shout out to the one guy in the tourism group with the big glasses who saw the monster and I think had the best facial expressions that I've seen. And definitely had the best acting in the entire movie. He looked genuinely afraid for his life and panicking about what to do. And that guy did his part very well.
The last thing I wanted to say was that from like beginning to end, I was just like, wow, this has aged so well in the sense of like, there are some movies that you watch as children and you're like, oh, this was so cool when I watched it and now it's kind of lame. But this film and then learning that like it was so important to in the making of other monster films, I was just like, oh, I can see why, because even though I can kind of tell how this was made, it's still really cool and really well done.
That's dope. I like that. Yeah, because I saw this in the 70s when I was a kid. Star Wars wasn't even out yet, so we really didn't have any sophisticated films around that time. So when this came on television, this was like, you know, the Japanese stuff was like way more deep in fantasy and stuff like that. So, you know, looking at this as 5-6 years old, I mean, I didn't know these were guys in suits. I thought they were real monsters. You could see their eyes. And even though I saw it every year, I was always anticipating, especially on the song, that, oh my, he's going to come. He's going to take the woman. But you always had this feeling of like, wow, this is so real, you know, and you get older and you appreciate all the little models and all the time it took and the actors and stuff like that. So yeah, I agree with you on that. That's how I felt watching it as a kid.
Bailey, did you have something else you wanted to say?
Well, I had two things. So this is my first real big monster movie because I'm a huge horror movie fan. I'm a big movie person, but I've never explored this before. And so for this to be like my foray was a real delight. And then also, I can't help it, but the green monster, the whole time I was watching it again, in my defense, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. I was like, this looks like old Greg by the way of King Kong. And so I was cracking myself up. But no, this movie was a delight. And I'm so excited that this was my first real monster movie.
Awesome.
That's so good. That's so great. Well, Jimmy, I know everyone watched this separately at different times, but what was it like to revisit this with everyone?
Oh, it was great. I mean, I talk about it all the time, and everybody else, you know, that I know, you know, being in animation, we watch stuff like this all the time. So a lot of people I know remembered it. But it was great. I mean, it was great meeting you all, and I'm a little nervous, but it's cool. You know, I mean, I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. I mean, it is one of those movies that's just, you know, it's just off-wall, campy, not taking yourself seriously, monster brawls, and just entertain me. It's a part of my, you know, my childhood, and it's just something I've always cherished, and my kids grew up on it, you know, and just, it's great to hear people talk about it. It's great.
Well, that is what this podcast is all about. It's like finding these movies that meant so much to us when we were younger and impacted us in some way or another. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share this movie with us and to talk with me and to talk with the rest of us. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's something that I've carried, you know, these movies, I have carried them into my career. And a lot of the stories that I've had in animation and on film, they're inspired off of these kind of films. So yeah, it's great to talk about them. And I thank you so much for having me once again. I mean, you're awesome.
You're awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, everybody else, for joining in and sharing your thoughts. This has been really, really great. And until next time, this has been Memory Static. Return your videos here.
Return your videos
Return
here.
Your videos here.
Here.
Right here.
Was I supposed to say that too? I'm sorry.
No. Completely optional.
It's not too late. Say it now.
Return your videos here.
Yay!
Right? Okay, there you go. Oh.